He says, I've got enough money, Mike. I'm going back down to Florida. I said, how are you going to get there? He says, oh, I hitchhike on the trucks. I said, how do you do that? He says, come here, I'll show you. So he goes up to one of the truckers that's parked right there. This is at the time when they had all the CBs were going crazy. Hey, truckers, you know, we got a convoy. They had music, they had songs. Everything was CB at the time. And so he walks up to one of the truckers and says, hey, trucker, can I use your radio? And so the trucker leans out and hands him a microphone with a big curly cord going up into the truck. And so he gets on the truck, and now you can hear when he keys the mic, you can hear all the other trucks are broadcasting what he's saying because they all got it on the same channel. They all put it on channel 19. That's the trucker's channel. So anyway, so this guy, this friend of mine, he gets on the radio, and as soon as he keys the mic, you can hear, hello, 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 hi, 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 because they all got the radio on the same channel, see? Mm. So he keys the mic, he says, hey, truckers, is anybody heading to Florida out there? I need a ride. I'll keep you awake all night, and I'll talk to you, and you can keep on driving, and I don't have any luggage or nothing. I have nothing I'm taking with me. So also one of them answered back, yeah, where you at? He says, I'm over here by the gas pumps. Come get me. He said, okay, here I come. So they come, and they pick him up because they need to stay awake. They want someone to talk to them, tell them stories, and they're going to get company all the way down to Florida, you know, say from Portland to Florida, 3,000 miles. So off he goes. He says, see you later, Mike. He says, oh, by the way, you can keep on doing the murals, you know. I said, okay, I will, you know. So immediately I go up and the next mural. Anyway, so I go up, and I'm doing it by myself. Hey, mister, can I do your mural? Sure, you know. So I get the ladder, and I'm up there, I charge $40, $50, and I'm doing the mural and getting the cash for it straight out, right? And it takes me longer, and I'm doing one guy's mural, and some of the paint comes off on my rag. And I look down at the rag, and I says, holy shit, you know. So I fold the rag so he can't see it, and I go really light, you know. I don't want to do it any harder than that, you know. So I get him done, and I look down at the rag when he drives away, and I got my money in my hand. I says, damn, there's a risk involved here, and I don't want that trucker to see the paint because he'll freak out. He might kick my ass, you know. So I'm thinking, shoot, you know, there's a drawback to this business that I didn't recollect at first. And the big guy that left to Florida, he would have said, fuck you type of thing, but I can't. I'm a little guy. I got to be careful. I says, damn it, you know, maybe this isn't the perfect job opportunity I thought it might be. So I says, damn. So I think about going up to the next trucker, and I want to do his mural, but I'm apprehensive about it now. I says, damn, I don't know if I could do it. Go to the other truck, and the next truck is in there, and I'm thinking to myself, maybe I could get, like, a waiver that says if I damage it, I won't be responsible for it, you know, because my mind's seen him taking the smile off the woman's face or something, you know, anything stupid. I says, it'll ruin the whole thing. I'll be out $1,000. I have to paint it over again or something stupid, you know. So I'm trying to think how I could say to the guy, look, if anything happens, I don't want to be responsible. So I go to the next guy, says, hey, can I do your mural? And he says, sure. I said, listen, if anything happens, I don't want to be responsible. Are you okay with that or what? And he says, what do you mean? I says, well, if the paint comes off or something. He says, no, nothing's airbrushed on or good. It's not going to come off. I says, will you agree that if it comes off, I'm not responsible? He says, well, maybe you ought to not do it. You know, I said, I'm thinking, damn, there goes the fucking business. I'm in a negative all of a sudden. I'm thinking, damn it. I says, well, is there anything else I can do for you? He says, well, come up here, Mike, and take a look at this right here. He says, see the front wheel on my truck? I says, there's a big giant wheel. And underneath the hubcap, they have to grease it. You know, saying, well, these trucks, some of them got a million miles on them. You can imagine they drive all over the country. They never turn them off. They don't even turn a big diesel off and on because it's harder to start them up than it is to keep them running. Plus, they have refrigeration units, they have air conditioning, they have their TVs and all these different draws to the battery. So they just leave the truck run all night, you know, so they just sit there idling, you know, blah, 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 blah. So the truck sits there and the guy's in there sleeping in the cab, you know, inside the truck. Anyway, so he says, see underneath this hubcap right here on my front wheels, and it's a big flat wheel that's all made out of aluminum and it's polished real pretty and stuff. He says, underneath there, they take off this hubcap right here and they grease the front end of it so that the axle grease will stay on the wheel so that it doesn't burn up the bearings. I says, okay. He says, but right here, see the way the oil is coming out of the hubcap and spraying all over my wheel? I says, yeah. He says, you can wipe that off of there. And I says, what are you paying? He says, I'll give you $10 to do each wheel. He says, okay, I'm on it, you know. He says, it's real important while I'm sitting there wiping it off, whatever, I have a special chemical that I'm taking it off with. He says, it's real important that we take that off there because the CHP will come up beside of us and they'll give us a ticket for that. And the ticket's like a couple $100. So he says, you got to have it done. And usually the truckers do it themselves, but it's a pain in the ass to bend over to do it. And I'm sure you can make money off of it. And I says, damn, I'm on it, you know. So pretty soon I'm going truck to truck. Hey, can I wipe the grease off your wheel? And sure, you know, I charge $5. And he says, okay, you know, so I'm doing it real quick. Now I could do 10 times more than the murals because every truck seemed to have grease. And I could see the situation from far away. Oh, there's one that needs it right there. So I run up onto him and, you know, I can immediately start talking to him, approaching him on that angle. That one of them had a really dull looking aluminum wheel. He says, it's kind of dull or whatever, you know, and I'm going to wipe it off anyway. And he says, go ahead and do it. He says, would you polish the wheel? And I said, well, how do you do that? He says, you use a special chemical. It's called Mother's Polish. And if you rub on it real hard with the rag right there, it'll make it look like chrome. And so I took it, and I went on the dull aluminum wheels. Pretty soon, it looks like chrome. I said, son of a bitch, that works pretty good, you know. But it's a lot of work, and you end up with a lot of tarnish on the rag, and that's important for later. You end up with this tarnish on the rag, and so you have to use a new rag for each wheel. So I says, okay, I did it for him, and he says, I'll give you $25 to do it. And I says, I'm there, you know. So I got $50 to do both sides, and they look like brand-new wheels or whatever, and he's off to the races. And so I says, man, that's a great opportunity, but it kind of wears you out. It's more labor-intensive than doing the mural. But I now notice that there's other parts of the truck that are dull, and I was wondering if that shit would work on that. So I go to the next driver. I say, hey, look, I see a dull spot in your tank. Can I polish that out to make it look nice? He said, sure. What do you charge? I says, I don't know, $20. He says, okay. You know, so I'm doing both sides, $40. And so I'm now in the business of polishing the aluminum to make it look like chrome. So one of the things I learned in my life is that if you take a cotton wheel, which is a wheel made out of pieces of cotton stuck together and sewn together, and you spin it with a drill or a grinder, it spins very fast, and you could use that to polish things. So I went home and got one of these things, and I went back to the truck stop, and now I could use my machine to polish it much quicker than my hand. 10,000 revolutions versus 200, what you could do in your hand. So anyway, so I go to the truck, I said, hey, can I turn that thing to chrome? And he's like, sure, you know. So to make the story shorter, I'm doing all the trucks, every piece of aluminum on the truck. And I had a price list. I says, to do the tanks is one price, to do the wheels is another price. I went down to an anodization plant, a place where they take trucks' parts. So I went into the plant, and I says, well, and it stunk like crazy because there's 200 tanks of different chemicals, 1,000 volts of electricity, and a lot of things involved. I said, what do you guys charge to anodize a tank on a truck? I said, well, first we have to take the fuel out, and you have to dump the fuel, and you don't get your money back on that. And I said, yeah. And he says, then we have to tank it through 20 different tanks. It costs $400 a piece or something like that, and we take 11 days to do it. And I says, $400 a piece? And he says, yeah, that's $400. And I says, okay, thanks. So now I go back to the trucks out loaded with the ammunition. I says, hey, look, you can have it done at the anodization plant over there for $800, or I'll do it for $80. Okay, do it, you know. So then I get my machine out there, and I crank away on it, and I crank it out. It comes out just like brand new or whatever, and they're like, yeah, that was worth it. So now they get on the radio. Hey, I got a glad hand over here doing tanks and wheels and stacks, you know, the big exhaust stacks, and the fifth wheel and everything else. He does it all, man. For a couple $100, you can do your own rigs. Now I got trucks in a line waiting to get done, you know. I said, son of a bitch. And I'm getting exhausted, and the stuff's kind of dirty, getting all over the place, all this harness, you know, from the rags and stuff gets sprayed because this machine is throwing a lot faster, so you end up covered with this little black tarnish shit, you know what I'm saying, from the machine. So anyway, so I says, damn, I got to get help, you know. So I look around, and they have a thing called a lumper, which is a guy that loads or unloads trucks for a truck driver, and they usually charge $100, you know, the lump your truck. And usually what it means is they go in the back of the trailer, and they move a pallet of stuff from the back of the trailer to the front of the trailer, so it's balanced when you go over the scales, it'll be balanced. They call these guys lumper. Yeah, they hang around big truck stops, and they have a sign that they make out of cardboard and a magic marker, and it says lump, L-U-M-P. So they're lumpers, you know what I'm saying? So that's a crew that are willing to go in the back of these hot-ass trailers and move that shit around. And I remember doing it a couple of times and said, oh, my God, it's exhausting. And you had to have two or three guys in each truck to pass the cases of stuff over the top of the load to the front of the load because they can't take off the whole load to move the pallet in front and put it all back on. Way too much involved. So they just have these guys lump it from one end to the other. So I was doing that for a while, and it's too exhausting. I said, this isn't for me. It's too sweaty. But I went to the lumpers that day and says, hey, you guys want a job? And they said, well, doing what? And I says, well, you're not going to lump a truck, but I'll have you just polish some wheels and shit. They're like, all right, what's the pay? And I said, I'll give you $100. And they said, okay. So now I got a line of trucks coming in. I got my lumper guys out there polishing away, and I'm back in control. I'm looking for the derby hat, you know, so I want to just be the guy that directs them what to do. I have a whole list that I had printed out of all the different variables that you can have done. I could either do your wheels, your stacks. I could do the mural. I can lump the load. I can secure your truck overnight for a price. You know, so we'll put a guy sleeping right on the top of the load. You know, sleep right there, and anybody gets near your truck, I'll yell at him or scare him away or whatever. So I had a whole list of services of different things to do. And what I did is I took an old station wagon, and I took an old set of stairs that you go to unload an airplane, a regular commercial airplane. They have the big stairs, the gangway they call it, that goes up to the side of an airplane. And I took one of those apart, and I welded it right to the back of my convertible car, and I put an Easy Boy recliner chair in the front of it. So I could drive my car right up, and it's the same level, 10 feet up, next to a truck driver's door. So they could literally open the door and fall right into the recliner. And now I got him in the front of my car right there, and I could see him right there. And immediately to his right, he has a whole list of all the different services we could do for his truck. On the other side, he had some cold beers already sitting on ice. And in front of him was a little TV that's plugged into my car, and he could watch TV. And so I turn to the driver, I yell out the window to him, I says, where do you want to go? The driver says, take me to the showers, you know. So now I could take him from the truck to the showers, which sometimes is a long walk. and now I'm driving them, catering to their needs. And at the same time, when we get to the showers, they climb down off the chair, and they had a list of all the different things they want done to the truck. And I say, okay, let me see. You want your stacks done, tires, wheels, fill up the air on the tires, check the load, secure the load overnight. You know, I had all these different things. And so I turn to them, I says, $500. And they whip out of their pockets. Every one of the truckers at the time had these huge wads of cash. And they pull $500 out of there like it was nothing. And we even went so far as some of the guys that would drive the truck for them and go fill it up with fuel so we could take it over to the fuel island, because the fueling takes a long time. It takes an hour to sit there waiting for the fuel to fill up in these huge tanks. So we would save the receipt and bring back to the driver, and we charge them a certain dollar for that, and they charge for the fuel, and pretty soon I'm handling a lot of money going back and forth, and I'm doing all the services, and I got all my guys working for me, and I made everybody wear a uniform, so we all looked the same, so we looked professional, so that we didn't look like a bunch of idiots out there. We all had the same uniform on.
Did you brand the name of your little business?
Yes, we were the Diner Shiners.
What? Did you have to get permission from the truck stop?
What I did was I went to the truck stop because I wanted to get exclusive on it, so I went up to the guy that owned the truck stop. His name is Mr. Jubitz, an old man, he's an old grandpa, you know, and I went into his office, and I said, hey, Mr. Jubitz, how you doing? He says, yeah, what do you want, son? And I says, I got this idea where I'm doing for the trucks. I'm doing all these services and stuff for them. Is there any way that I could do it exclusively? I got a crew of guys. We're all in uniform. You see them out there. They're all standing outside of his window so he can look out of his executive offices and see us out there on the lot. And he says, well, listen, son, I don't want you to get run over by a truck or nothing. I says, yeah. He says, I'm going to give you a quarter of the lot over there next to the truck wash, and you can set up a big tent and set up everything you need right there. I can keep an eye on you guys. At the same time, you won't get hurt. I says, that'd be great. You know, I says, you don't want no money for it? He says, nah, I need it for the truckers. They need the service, and they'll appreciate it. You know, so I says, okay, would you put it in writing? And he did, you know, so I got it in writing that I was the only guy that'd be doing it out there, me and my crew, the Diner Shiners, and we're kind of like detailing trucks now. And at the same time, we do all these different services. It's so funny, I want to tell you, the number one service that they're willing to pay for no matter what, whatever it costs, we take them in four-wheelers, usually they belong to my crew, and we take them to church. Because they can't get off the trucks, they can't get away from the lot without having it secured, and they wanted to go to the Presbyterian church that was 3 miles away. Some of them were Jewish that wanted to go to the synagogue 5 miles. We'd take them to their denomination, wherever they wanted. They had the addresses and stuff, and they'd pay us like $100. Every one of the truckers are very religious, I learned, because they're taking their life in their hands. They love to pray and to worry about the Lord above them and stuff, and take their truck down the road and make it go from point A to point B safely and all that stuff. So that little blessing, whatever, made me more money than all the detail work involved. And while we're going, I would take them to a different place other than a restaurant. They'd pay $100 to go to my house and have my girlfriend cook them lunch, because it wasn't restaurant food, you know. So it was something, it was home-cooked meal, and we'd have great stews and great roasts and, you know, different things on the barbecue and stuff, and they were like, oh, man. And they go to our house, and for 1 hour of their life, they get to relax, they go to church, another hour, they get to have a home-cooked meal, and they go back to their truck, they can forget about everything about life and go back, and their loads are secured, the fuels are tanked up, they're ready to go, everything's polished, you know, so we're checking their oil, we're doing everything they could possibly do to a truck, and now they're back in the truck and going for the haul, and they can go rested, you know, so they can feel really good about not having all the different drawbacks to being in that trucker's life.
What's the lesson, and what kind of money did you make?
Oh, I made hundreds of thousands of dollars a week, man. There's so much money involved with it, you know, because there were so many trucks. I was not only doing trucks, but pretty soon Harley-Davidson motorcycle gang showed up. So I would do 200 motorcycles, you know, saying all the different pieces of chrome on the bike and all the aluminum had to be polished out, and all of them wanted it done, and they paid the big money because they're rich. And I started learning there's other people that had serious money. Eventually, I did Kirby vacuum cleaners because it took 11 days to break down a Kirby vacuum cleaner, send it to a factory and have it polished and send it back. They had to pay like $60 for each one of them to have it done so they could sell it as a used vacuum. Well, I would do it right on the spot with my machines, my men, in about 5 minutes.
Did the Kirby dealers come to you?
I went to the first Kirby dealer because I thought they're all aluminum. Let's see if this shop over here sells them used. And sure enough, they had brand new and they had used, and the used ones were less, but I could make them look like the brand new ones, and the guys paid for it. Now, they lined them up as I got to the shop every day. They'd have 10 of them lined up. Kirby called up Eureka, called up Hoover. They called up Hoover and says, you know, Mike, come down to Hoover. And I said, where's it at? So I was getting turned on to different guys. And by the way, I have a motorcycle at home. Can you do my bike? Sure. So one day I'm driving along and I look up and I see Coca-Cola International, a huge giant place with 1,000 Coca-Cola trucks out there in the lot, and this little Mexican guy was out there scraping away with a razor blade the giant sign that says, things go better with Coca-Cola. They're taking off the big sticker off the side of the truck tank, which are all made out of stainless steel. And I went up to the office. I said, man, that guy's ruining that tank. You can see the scratch lines all over it. I says, I could take that off of there without ruining the tank, and you could put your other sticker on it. He says, oh, you can't. How much do you want? And I says, well, what do you pay me for it? I think you told me I'll give you $500 a side. So I made $1,000 off each truck to take off the big stickers and put on the ones that says, it did say things go better with Coca-Cola, and they put on Enjoy Coke was the new one.
How'd you take them off?
I used chemicals. I used my knowledge in chemicals and the polishers and stuff, and I took it right off. And what I did is I walked along and poured a chemical on it, and it fell right on the ground smoking. And he says, God damn it, I never thought in a million years it would come off that easy. Yeah, in the meantime, I had a contract with them, and I had them sign it and everything else so that I didn't get screwed out of the deal and have them just do it right around my back. And also, I had the exclusive rights to do every truck on the lot. 1,000 trucks. Says, this is going to take some time. I says, I got a crew of 10 guys. We're going to come over. So anyway, so I'm doing the cola trucks. I'm doing the Kirby's vacuums. I'm doing motorcycles. I'm doing semis. And I got crews in every different direction, you know, that I'm running around every different way. And one day, I went in front of a Safeway food store, and I realized that the frames around the front of the store were made out of aluminum. I says, mister, I can make this look like this. And by this time, I had samples that I bring with me. Everywhere I went, I had a sample, and it would take the old tank that was all pitted and had holes and scratches all over it, and I'd polish it and it looked like brand new on half of it. So I says, I can make this look like this. And every place I turned, they said, do it. You know, don't even waste time, just do it. And I said, okay. And then I tell them the price, whatever it was. And so I'm doing storefronts. At one point, I polished the chain link fence so it looked like chrome. So any trucker that had any questions, I said, we're going to do it like the fence right there. And they're like, holy shit, man, do it. So one day, my guys are all kind of burnt out. I had 20 guys working for me. We're all making $1,000 a day, and I'm making serious money. And we go to the races. I said, listen, guys, I want to treat everybody to the international stock car races. And, all right, you know, we don't have to work. I said, hell no. So we go out there. And a lady named Shirley Modani, she's a famous car driver, so she turned to me and she says, listen, our semi came through the truck stop. We had the cars in the back of the truck, and you guys did the truck. I said, yeah. And I didn't know it was you. And she says, yeah. She says, can you do my drag car? I says, I certainly can. So they got us pit passes and free everything we wanted, you know, free dinner, free beer, free whatever. And she says, hey, listen, my other friends out here want to do it too. So we did like 150 drag cars, just insane. And the funniest thing was that she lined that thing up, and they looked absolutely beautiful. And they pull up to the line, that thing would just shine, you know, like a brand new car. And they get to do the race. They're doing a 280-mile-an-hour race. And they drag it with another truck back down to the starting line, and it had to be redone again, the whole car. So that's the biggest secret to making any money, is to take something that's worthless and turn it into something valuable. And it takes the idea, the ingenuity, and the outside the thinking box to figure out what it takes to make something improve it. And that's the lesson for everybody that does any sales, whatever it is. They do the same exact thing. They take something that either isn't working or it's working slowly, and they figure out how to accelerate it into a money-making proposition by simply adding something or taking something away from it so that it's improved.
Or doing something different. Now let's go back to that piano and why you hung it upside down in that store.
It has an aesthetic value that's different, and it's a curiosity. And people scratch their head and say, how in the heck, number one, did you get it up there? Number two, why? And how come it looks so much better? You know what I'm saying? It looks different upside down than it does from looking down at it from myself. When you got a carving in front of you and you're carving it out, you've executed it from this level. You're looking at it from this perspective, looking down at it or whatever. So if you take the same piece and turn it around and turn it upside down, you'll see all the mistakes. Oh, I didn't get a chance to do back there. I didn't do the bottom of the feet. So when you stand it back up on its regular point of view, that's the angle of execution, they call it. So when you change something around to a different angle of execution, you see something different. It's a whole different perspective. So I had to learn over my lifetime that I can't sell a sculpture elevated up. I can't put it up on a pedestal and sell it the same as I can on the ground, because I didn't take the time to do all the things underneath. All the underside, the bottom of the chin isn't done, the bottom of the ears isn't done, the bottom of their legs. So you have to change either your perspective on it or put it back to the original place where you carved it to sell it, so that they don't see all the mistakes and they don't see what isn't done. They see only what is done. And you don't have to waste a lot of time doing all the stuff on the bottom side and the back side. That's how I made really well doing carvings, because all the other artists made it a point to get down on their knees, and they carve on their knees and all sorts of places that wasn't really necessary to carve, because the person's not going to appreciate it, number one, and they're not going to display it from there. So by hanging from the ceiling upside down, I could see that the piano had different angles and lines that weren't normally appreciated. You know, you can see the way the whole volume of it looks different, the shape and the lines and the different things that the artists that made it, you know, Baldwin or whoever, they took a lot of time to make this thing. But you don't see it when you're looking straight on at it, looking at the keys. You lose all the art value of what the piano actually looks like when it's big and far away and you're looking straight down on it. You can't usually look straight down on a piano on a stage unless you get lifted up above it looking straight down on it. So there's a different artistic view from down below. You see different lines and a different perspective that you don't see when the piano's on the ground. And by doing that or whatever, I learned right away that you could just simply hang it upside down and get twice what it's worth.
So we're talking about perspective. We talked about Jackson Pollock, and you decided to start doing paintings.
Well, my dad was a painter all of his life. He painted 3,000 canvases that he knows about, and none of them sold. And I started to say, why wouldn't they sell? He stopped painting for 45 years and just went away from it. He enjoyed them. They're all over the house and every single wall of my life. When I grew up as a kid, there were all these paintings everywhere, and they weren't sold. So they started to varnish and turn brown after 50 years of hanging on the wall. They get dusty and stuff. I said to myself, someday I'm going to inherit my father's paintings. When he's dead and gone, they're not going to know what to do with all these paintings. They're not going to sell it any stores, any galleries, so I have to figure out what to do with them myself. I'm going to be stuck with them. And by the way, I have 100 of them right now that are all over this house that I still haven't worked on, because what I decided to do was to add to it. I wanted to take this painting that was already painted by somebody else and add to it without ruining it and feeling like my dad might be looking down at me, what are you doing to my painting, ruining it? But I would just simply add a little detail or add more color to it to brighten it up and to make it more appealing to the average person, to make it look better. So I had to learn how things are looked at, you know, from the artist view. I had to learn about execution levels, you know, so to get the perspective levels of where he was standing when he painted the painting and stuff. And I also had to add to it without ruining it, you know, so I wanted to not ruin the painting. So eventually, I wanted to practice. This is before I got my dad's actual paintings. So I was in the swap meet, and I seen this big, giant canvas, and it was already painted by somebody. It was an ugly-looking thing, whatever it was on there. It looked stupid. And I bought it cheap. I bought it for like $5 or something for the canvas because it was only good for just painting over it. And the guy sold it to me quickly. It was an easy sale. So I took it home, and I added my own paints to it, and I painted it over again. But I did it just abstract because I really don't know how to paint very well detail. I'm not an artist in that perspective. I can't paint beautiful paints or whatever. I did the Jackson Pollock on it, and I didn't want to do random squirts of paint because that has too much what's called quantum mechanics. Like, you don't know where it's going to land or how it's going to splatter, so it's totally haphazard. So I learned about Monet's painting, how he painted. And he would place each piece of paint onto the canvas exactly where he wanted it to be. And I wanted to learn what made his so appealing and how he made a living off it for 75 years. He painted the same garden behind his house for 75 years. And he had 12 people that he basically paid all their things in life with. He had gardeners, he had his family, his kids, his wife, his mother, his father. So he painted for 12 people, and they all made a living off of his painting for 75 years, but it was the same garden. And I thought, isn't that amazing that you could take the same garden and have different perspectives and still keep people pleased and have a huge demand for your paintings? By the time he died, people were paying millions of dollars for his paintings while he's still alive. So that was a big plus, too. So I wanted to study Monet, and I did, and I wanted to apply it to the paintings, which I did. And the first one that I did, I painted it and put it out just on the corner, just a bunch of paintings leaning against the tree. And when I sold it to a woman from La Jolla, she came along and says, oh, I love it. I got to have it. So I stuck my hand out and says, lady, put in there whatever you want, because I didn't want to beat myself up. A lot of artists, and this is an important lesson, will beat themselves up because either A, they work on the same project for a year, a long time, too much time invested in one painting, and at the same time, they've invested a lot of time and energy and money and their souls and their thinking pattern or soul. And so pretty soon they say, damn, I want to get this thing sold. So they say, it's worth $5,000. But I'll take $1,000 for it. And some guy will come along, unfortunately, in life, they'll say, I'll give you $500 for it. And some artists will say, okay, I'll take it. So they've beaten themselves up for $4,500, you know, and they've taken away their own value, unfortunately. It's their own mind that did that to make it so that they sold themselves short. So I didn't want to sell myself short on the first one. At the same time, I didn't want to sell it. It's a big cumbersome piece. I didn't want to wreck it or poke a hole through it. I wanted to sell it. So I put my hand out and says, lady, put in there whatever you think it's worth. And so I turned my head the other way, and she shoved a bunch of money out of her purse in my hand. And when she drove away, I counted the money, and it was over $400. I says, oh, my God, I'm an artist. I was repressed as a child to go near my dad's paintings because he thought I would ruin them, which I did a couple of times. I'd poke my finger or I'd throw a football around the house and it hit one of his wet canvases and it'd wipe out something he'd worked hard on. You know, repressed and scolded and beat down and never get near the paintings no matter what. This is my chance to paint my own, and I did, and I sold the first one. And I says, I beat my old man in 3,000 canvases because I turned the first one over immediately. So the lady came to a sale of mine that I had a month or two later, and she says, hey, you want to come see the painting that I sold to her? And I said, yeah, I would. So I went to see the painting, and she took me into her big, beautiful home in La Jolla, and she had nothing in the house. It was very, what they call, sparsely decorated. She had one Ming vase at the entranceway, and everything else was just simple pieces of furniture without any clutter. People that have a lot of wealth usually don't have a lot of clutter in their life. They don't buy things as a mistake. They don't buy things because they like it. They don't buy things impulsively. They buy what's usually a valued item that they're going to covet and love, you know. And in front of her six-chair dining room table that was gorgeous, you know, from Europe or something, was my painting hanging on the wall, and she invested $200 into the frame on it. But, man, when you've seen that painting, you know, it's in just a big abstract, choreographed bunch of paints just on a canvas, it absolutely made the house. Suddenly I seen the value of it. I says, wow, no wonder she gave me that money for it, because look at it. It looks like it's worth $1 million in the place that it's at, because it's very chaotic in a place that's very organized, you know. So it immediately had an amazing value that I've seen. And since then, I've sold over 350 paintings that I make as fast as I can. I'm looking at one right now as I sit here. There's a big canvas against the wall right next to a actual canvas that looks, it's an exact copy of Van Gogh's irises in the garden. So I got mine sitting right next to it, you know, and so I have one of those and I love it. My girl hates it, you know, I kind of behind the door, behind the TV. I love it. I look at it. There's millions of different little images that are in the irises that I love to pull out of there and see the perspective. But I have my canvases right in front of it that I'm working on. Right now I'm looking at one that's full of goldfish and it's a sea life goldfish painting that it's not complete yet. But I decided I'd start to paint canvases myself. And unfortunately, even though I sold 350 of them, there's no real way to make a living off it. And I did all the different tricks that Monet talks about. He says, never paint a canvas more than 10 minutes so that you don't have any more time in it than that. So if you get $100 for it, you're getting $100 every 10 minutes. So I did all the different things that he says to do. And even then, it's still too hard to make a living off it, because in California, there's such a competitive need for a wall space that if anybody had any more space on the wall to put a painting up, they would just simply cut a frame and make a window so they could look outside of beautiful California. Where if we're in New York or Chicago or Detroit or something, everything's so ugly outside that they'd rather hang the painting in front of the wall so you don't have to look outside. So there's no real big giant demand for artists here for their paintings, unfortunately. Keep it in mind if you're a painter that you want to go either to a different city with your work, or maybe the sculptures didn't take the same wall space. So I did very well with sculptures. I made and sold over 10,000 sculptures so far in my life, and I still have 10 of them out in the garden that I haven't finished that I'm working on right now. And so there's a big demand for paintings, but there's not a big demand for floor space. You can still fit a sculpture in that corner over there, behind there, in the garden, whatever it is. You still got non-competitive spaces in the homes to fill up with sculptures where you don't have that with the paintings, unfortunately. People, if they have any more space on their wall, they would hang a picture of their mother instead of a piece of art, because there's so many variables to the different arts. So one of the things I did in my life is I was going along, and there's a big lot across from the promenade. It's a strip mall that's 2 or 3 blocks long. It's right on the beach. I'm sure you've seen it before. It has Tony Rama's ribs in there and a pizza place and a few other big anchors, you know, that anchor the lot. So they spent years building this thing, and they spent $15 million, but they had across the street a huge, giant parking lot that they parked all the heavy equipment that they would roll across the street to work on it. It's right on La Jolla Boulevard. And I seen the potential with this big lot, because one day I was going along and some very rich young men from La Jolla, some young people, probably about 18 years old, had rented the lot and they put Christmas trees on it. But in order to cover the ground, they used a bunch of hay on the gravel. But the hay didn't come off the gravel so easy when they went to clean it up. They got off the lot. They tried to sell Christmas trees. The Christmas trees are very expensive. They wanted $200 for a Christmas tree, and they didn't sell any. They had about 20 trees out there. They thought they were going to go big with the idea, but they didn't sell not one tree. So they left in a huff, and they were angry and disgruntled, and they left all the trees laying around the lot that weren't sold, which were 20 of them, and they left all the hay on the ground, which is a bunch of gravel with this hay on it. So I found out who owned the lot, because up until that point, I thought it was owned by the city or the state or somebody, and now I realize it's an independently owned lot that you could get somebody to rent it. So I found out who owned it, and I found out he's owned several pieces of property at the beach, and I told him I would clean up the lot and take all the hay away and all the Christmas trees if I could get the lot cheap. And it's a 100,000 square foot lot, and I rented it for about $1,000 a month, which is absolute peanuts versus where the location of it is everything. It's just the most amazing place in the city.
Boom, there you go. Part 5 is complete. I hope you're getting a lot out of this recording and interview. Please continue to part 6.